everyone, and welcome to another edition of Stick to Wrestling. My name is John McAdam. I am here with my good friend Sean Goodwin. Sean, how are you today?
I'm doing well. So last week, we kind of thrown it out to the listeners to ask some questions that we can answer this week. And the format was pretty much going on to our Facebook page. We can get that out of the way early. And just, you know, whatever question you want, and we'll just try to go through as many of them today as possible. And we got a bunch.
Yeah, we got a lot of good ones. I mean, and it's always sad when I come in knowing that we're not going to get to answer all of the good ones because there are so many good ones. Before we get into that, I talked a little bit, I don't know, a couple of weeks ago. Like, right now we are recording this. It's 9 o'clock on Thursday, September the 20th. So, like, as soon as this is done, it's basically going to get released. And I'm very excited, Sean, because today was the day that I went out and bought the Death of the Territories book. I have it. It's at my house.
Tim Hornbaker's book, right?
Yeah. Now, give me an honest answer, and you don't have to. Like, are you going to buy this and read it?
Yeah, I have read two of his books so far. One was the NWA, the history of the NWA, and the second one was his history of McMahon, New York wrestling, basically Madison Square Garden.
Okay, yeah, I remember
and, which
that.
I thought was tremendous. It was Capital Wrestling. I thought Capital Wrestling was fantastic. So if it's anywhere near as good as that, then that is, it should be fantastic.
Yeah, I have not even gotten to open it yet because, you know, I got it on my way home. But, I mean, I'm really excited about this book. If you're going to read it anyway, we will definitely do a show about that. But I'll tell you what, my experience buying this book reminds me of why people use Amazon, because I go into Barnes & Noble, and, you know, whenever I'm at the cash register and someone says, would you like to? And I'm always like, please say pay and leave, because that's all I want to do. I don't want your rewards card. I don't want any of this stuff. And there's a line because they're bothering people with this. It's like, oh, my God, I'll just like pay the slave master at Amazon next time. But anyway.
Kindle, so, my friend, Kindle. You just hit the little
too.
Button and they rocket it right into your little device.
I am like Brian Last. And you know what, people, I guess you just get to a certain age. Oh, I'm not even telling the truth. My mom uses Kindle, but I like having an actual book. I don't know what it
you know,
is. I just like having
I used
book.
To say this before, too, but the technology is getting so good that it's difficult to tell the difference. It's so convenient. You don't have to get off your couch. You sit there and go, oh, I want Death of the Territories. Boom, one button right in your Kindle.
Yeah.
You don't have to get up to deal with anybody. You don't have to talk to anybody. It's beautiful.
You don't have to talk to anybody. You just sold me on this.
Beautiful.
Don't have to deal with anybody. Oh, man.
No.
Oh, I'm excited.
No stupid traffic. No idiots on the way up. No idiots on the way back. No idiots in the store. It's beautiful.
You know, I don't know if you know this, but you are required to be an idiot to drive your car in Nashua, New Hampshire. It is like law out here. It is so – the people are so goddamn stupid. When we first moved here from New York – this is like 75. My dad was like, you know, these people up here are insane. They suck at driving. And whenever I drive through New York, I'm never like, wow, this must be like the Harvard of driving schools that people go to. I don't see a difference. But when you are in and around Boston, like that is where the really crazy drivers who don't pay attention are, except you, of course.
These roads were made 400 years ago for horses and buggies. Okay, New York are redone. These are still horses. This is 400 years of rage having to deal with these stupid roads for this long. Okay, that is what the whole mass hole thing is. Okay, you learn how to drive on these roads.
Yeah, when ECW came out with Hostile City Showdown, I'm like, oh, this is in Boston, right? Now,
yeah.
Apparently there was some USA Today article that was just all wrong. Wow, that didn't take us long to get way off track, did it?
Yeah.
Never does.
Good
but
start.
Anyway, I will let you pick the first question.
I liked this one from Neil Shockett. You can go to a supercard today in your hometown, feature any wrestlers you want from any era. Basically, the idea is that you could have, I'll give the example he gave, say 1981 Don Maronco versus 1974 Jack Briscoe.
And this is going to take place in our hometown. Okay. I kind of read the question differently, but the way you said it actually makes a little more sense. I thought it was like, create a supercard in 1979, for example. But okay, if I had to create a supercard from any era, it would definitely, and I can only pick one Ric Flair. So it would be 1989 Ric Flair against 1979 Ricky Steamboat in the main event for sure.
Why 89 Flair?
I honestly thought that was his best year, and maybe it was his opponents. Maybe it was just the nature of the promotion, you know, having taken over, you know, Dusty Rhodes finally got out of there. But 89 Flair is my favorite.
He was smarter in the ring, but he was more athletic early on. I liked the combination early on. If I had to pick a year for Rick, I'd probably say somewhere like 81, 83. I loved him in 85. I can't say a bad thing about him that year.
All right. What would be your main event?
Main events. Which one do I want to go with? I just wrote down a list of them. 1973 Dusty Rhodes versus 1981 Tommy Rich. 73 Rhodes. He's a heel.
Oh, well, I already like this. Now, down the card, I would have 1979 Terry Funk and Dory Funk Jr. against 1995 Mitsuharu Misawa and Kobashi, Kenta Kobashi.
Okay, if we're going for a tag team, I have a couple.
Right.
I'll start off with the 1966 Assassins and versus, say, the Interns from 72.
All right. Interns, wow, that's interesting. I always thought that was such a cool gimmick, Dr. Ken Ramey and the Interns.
Yep, they were the first ones to do the ether gimmick.
I didn't know that. I did not know that. That is too funny. That's great.
That's where the doctor, that was the whole gag, is that, you know, that Ramey would do the ether thing.
That is fantastic. Wow. And let me see, I have to have Sayama in here, 1982 Sayama against 1989 Great Muta.
1959 Jackie Fargo versus 1981 Jerry Lawler. Flip the roles, Jackie's a heel.
Okay, all right. And this will be my last one, 1976 Jack Briscoe against, 2001 Kurt Angle.
I got two more. Right. Gordy and Snuka, 1981 versus Hanson DiBiase, 1985.
Ooh, I like that one too.
Uh-huh. And just for some fun, I went with Ron Wright, 1970 versus Dutch Mantel, 1976.
Okay, I am totally digging it. This one is from Laszlo Tokic, and I hope that I pronounced that one correctly. No one talks about Vern Gagne as world champ. I'd like to know how he ranks in your opinion compared to the other world champs. He held the AWA title 10 times in one span from 68 to 75. How does he compare to Bruno the Funks Bockwinkel? I know more about territory owner Vern Gagne than I do world champ Vern Gagne. What are your thoughts, Sean?
Tremendous. The problem is, there's not really a lot of footage of Vern when he was a champ, when he was the world champ.
I know someone who's probably going to get a couple of DVDs soon.
Oh, is there? I haven't seen a lot of him as world champ, but what I have seen, I've actually seen more of him in Chicago.
That's what I have.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying, the early Chicago days. But as the AWA champion, I mean, there's not a lot of AWA stuff out there from the 60s, is there?
No, there isn't. There isn't. You're right.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking
about. The Chicago stuff. But, I mean,
so,
go ahead.
That's what I was going to say. Just going by the Chicago stuff, he's fantastic. Just as good a pure baby face. And you know who he kind of reminds me of is, except Vern's a better wrestler, is Terry Taylor in 85. He had that kind of pure kind of baby face, but he had a little bit of nastiness when necessary. But it was a real kind – it was a clean gimmick, though. And he did it well.
I remember one of my mom's friends – we're going back to the 70s talking about how Vern Gagne was her favorite wrestler growing up as a little girl, because Vern was so handsome and he was, you know, very pure and athletic. And I mean, to answer the question, I mean, Vern, I think if he didn't make the business decision to break off from the NWA, establish the AWA, and create himself as the top guy, which, by the way, if Vern Gagne wasn't running the AWA, Vern Gagne would have been the perfect person to be the lead star of the AWA. I mean, he was that good. He main evented up here in Madison Square Garden. I think if we did like the what if stuff about, someone asked me during that show, like, you know, what if Bruno Sammartino couldn't be WWF champion? Vern Gagne would have been, and we're going back to when Bruno beat Buddy Rogers. I mean, Vern Gagne would have been the perfect guy if he were available to be up here in the Northeast and doing what Bruno did.
Well, how about this? How about Vern doesn't break off? He stays in the NWA. And they start getting sick of Buddy Rogers.
Which they did, but go ahead.
Which they did. And so as opposed to putting in Lou to make sure business is going to take care of, you put in Vern, same difference. I mean, no one's going to shoot on Vern.
No.
What happens then? You have Vern as the NWA champion in the early 60s.
I was going to say, Vern, had he not done that, had he not, you know, gone off by himself to the AWA, I think he really would have cut into Luthez's legacy.
Yeah, he would seem to be the guy you'd put there, wouldn't he? If you're going to put somebody, if he stayed, he was the best guy, and he was young enough. I mean, was he too? How big was he?
He was big enough.
Okay, so he was big enough. He seemed to be the guy. Because when they gave you that U.S. championship, that meant you were the guy.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, when they get that Chicago U.S., because that was the belt for the because the way it broke down is back then you'd have two shows of the national shows. You'd have the East Coast version, which filmed out of Chicago, and then you had the West Coast version, which was out of Los Angeles.
Were those the Hollywood Stadium shows, or am I thinking of something
right.
else?
Right. Nope,
okay.
Those are the Hollywood Stadium shows. So that would have been, so if you were like west of the Mississippi, that's the show you're getting, is the Hollywood show. If you were east, you were getting the Chicago show.
Okay.
I think that's how it worked, because you just couldn't do, it's too difficult to do nationwide back then.
Yeah.
And if you were basically the champion of that show, if you were the U.S. champion. So you had a big audience that you were looking at all the time. So, and Vern did have that belt. So it looked, that tells me that they were looking at him as the NWA champion.
To answer Lazo's question, I mean, I think, you know, we're talking about him, Vern Gagne, in rarefied air here. You know, he was a legend's legend. We're talking about him along the same lines as Bruno Sammartino or Luthez. Let me throw this in really quick, too. I don't know why I feel obliged to say this. Buddy Rogers was a tough guy. And it just goes to show you how, you know, what a badass Luthez was, what a badass Vern Gagne was, that, you know, we all, even though Buddy was a tough guy, we have very little question of what the outcome would be had Buddy gone after either of those guys for real.
Tough then is different than tough now.
Yeah.
I mean, you had to be like, you had to have some legitimate chops. Even like the lesser guys, you didn't really have too many guys who were like nothing. I mean, that didn't really start until you got to the 80s. But if you were back in the 60s, most of those guys had some skills and could go.
No,
so even
question.
someone like Buddy Rogers, who will beat the crap out of 95% of the population and not even, you know, break a sweat, will get, you know, stretched by those two guys.
Exactly.
Because they were bad men.
And while we're here, I don't think we've mentioned this on the show before, but they had a posthumous special on Bruno Sammartino, which is available on WWE Network. Bruno says that the 60-second match or whatever it was where he won the title from Rogers was a shoot. He just said, you know, he told Buddy, hey, we're doing it my way, and Bruno just grabbed him and threw him over his shoulder.
Supposedly he said, give it up or I'm going to break your bleeping back. Was the line. Bruno's been telling this story for a long time. Now, let's take it from Bruno's perspective. Why wouldn't you say that?
Yeah, really?
Who's going to dispute it?
Well, yeah, and you know, the question comes up: is it true or not? I mean, Bruno's one of those guys that, even though he's a bit of a kayfaber sometimes, or at least he was. Like when that came out, I had no reason to disbelieve him, and I know Buddy at the time was not doing well. He had either just had a heart attack or was about to, and he just wasn't himself. And there's no question in my mind, you know, just because he wasn't well, Bruno could have done anything he wanted to him.
And Buddy wasn't a kid at the time.
That's right.
I mean, Buddy had been
here for like 18 years after that.
Yeah, Buddy had been a top of the line guy for top of the card guy for probably 17, 18 years by that point. I mean, he was around in the he was top of the cards in the late 40s, wasn't he?
Early 50s is what I'm aware of, but I could be wrong. Okay. I'm not like the Buddy Rogers expert that I should be.
Exactly.
But you're probably right. He probably was, you know, not only getting on in age, but, you know, once again, he was not doing well physically.
And certainly possible, but I have to, you know, take it with a grain of salt as well. Because, and it also, Buddy's not going to really say too much about it either, because he could sit there, the guy sandbagged me. What do you want me to do?
Yeah, exactly.
Supposedly when Buddy found out about this, he was already up on Bruno's back. Yeah, what are you going to do? I mean, if you want to believe the story that Bruno tells. So, it rings true. It sounds like a conversation that could happen. But, I don't know. One of the beauties of wrestling.
I believe it more than I disbelieve it.
Yeah, I'd say I'm there. I'm there, about 50-50. Maybe 60-40.
All right, your turn. So, what question do you want to pick out of these? We got so many good ones, man. Alan.
We do. Let me see one that... okay, I like this one. Brian Crawley asked, one, if Ric Flair never returns to the ring after the plane crash, how does this impact wrestling? Two, if Vincent K. McMahon buys the AWA from Vern instead of buying the WWF from his old man, how does that change wrestling?
Okay, to answer number one, wrestling would have been denied, my favorite wrestler of all time, Ric Flair. I mean, it wouldn't have been as happy a place, but I don't think anything would really be different, or there would have been a different outcome, like, wrestling would be less popular today or anything like that. I think if anything, if Rick had, not returned to wrestling after that plane crash, I think Greg Valentine would have gotten everything that Rick got. And instead of being like the number two behind Rick in the heel pecking order, which Valentine more or less was, especially, late 70s, I think, he would have wound up being number one. He'd be in the Observer Hall of Fame and all that good stuff. But that's about it.
Here's a sentence I wrote down as an answer. One, Ted DiBiase becomes a much bigger deal.
I could totally see that.
I think it would have been Ted, and this is why. Ted could babyface. Ted could heel. Greg can't really babyface.
I was thinking about that earlier today. No, he can't.
I mean, that's the problem in Greg's game right there. I mean, he would, if he could have, he would have been one of the all-time greats. I mean, he still is one of the all-time greats. But, I mean, in this rarefied air we're talking about with Rick and these guys, DiBiase, he absolutely could with ease. He can go to one town, be a babyface, go to the next town, be a heel.
You know what? The more I think about it, you're right. If it hadn't been for Flair, DiBiase would have been the perfect guy in 1981 to put that belt on. And, more than rumor has it, he was supposed to get the belt at one point, and they just wound up not doing it.
And size-wise, he would have matched up nicely against Hogan. I mean, he wasn't Hogan size, but he was closer.
He was a big guy. He was legit, like 6'4".
Yeah. That's what I'm saying. I mean, you're kind of in the ballpark when you put them side by side.
Yeah, I mean, no one looked at Ted DiBiase when he was up here against Hogan saying, he's too small. He was a lot bigger, taller. He may not have had the musculature that a lot of the heels had. I'm not saying he had a bad body or anything like that. He just wasn't the ultimate warrior. But, yeah, he was fine. He would have been fine in that role.
My concern about Ted would be, I knew he did have some personal problems with that era, but so did Rick, for that matter. Could that have been an issue with Ted at some point?
We're talking 81 here?
Yeah.
I'm going to say no because he was fine. You know, it wasn't like he...
It's true. I mean, you always meet his date, stuff like that. But I just know how much more intense the champion schedule is.
Now, see, well, I didn't know that Ted was having issues in 81. I remember I was talking to someone in 84 was saying, like, you know, Ted put on some weight because he was going through a divorce and things weren't going well for him. So he was going through stuff in 81, too. Yikes.
I may be a little early on it, but Ted, even in his book, Ted said he was having some drug issues. I'm trying to remember when it started.
Okay, was it in his most recent meaning, like probably like 15 years ago, and a lot of it was about religion?
Yeah.
Okay, I did not pick that one up. I have the earlier one, and I don't remember anything really being brought up about that.
Okay, but either way, you're right, though. It never really took an effect on the way he performed anyway, so I was just more looking at how much more intense the schedule can be.
Yeah. All right, what was part two?
And part two was, if Vincent K. McMahon buys the AWA from Vern instead of buying the WWF from Vincent J., how does this change wrestling?
I think it would. I mean, first of all, I don't think Vince McMahon was going to buy the AWA and go up against his dad. I mean, then again, you know, if this was in 84 after his dad had passed, or let's say just, I don't know, Vince got out of it in 82, or Vince Sr. got out in 82, and Vince just decided to buy the AWA, I think he would have done what he did on a national level, just under a different name.
Exactly. Exactly. He may have had to take a different avenue because he didn't have as big of a centerpiece as Madison Square Garden, but he would have done the exact same thing, and the old man knew it too.
Oh yeah, I mean, the stories were that, you know, Vince Jr. would do something, and one of the old guard would call Vince Sr. and say, "Hey, what's going on?" And Vince Sr. would be like, "Oh, you have nothing to worry about. Of course you didn't. You know, yeah, right.
Nice."
But anyway,
so, yeah, you would have the exact same situation. He would have tried to make the national move. He's the one who saw it in the tea leaves.
All right. Here's one. This is Kevon Vidotti. According to Cornette, JCP's business was picking back up around the summer of 1988. What would have happened if Crockett hadn't sold to Turner? Where would JCP have ended up? What do you think?
You were going to have to – who comes in after Dusty? Now, I have more faith the fact that they're going to pick the right guy after Dusty, because you had to get rid of Dusty at that point.
Not according to Crockett, but go ahead.
Okay, that's another problem. If you keep going along that avenue, then yes, you're going under either way. It's just a matter of time. Dusty was – he was burned out at that point. And they were spending way too much money, and they had to get rid of Dusty. Not as a performer necessarily, but you had to give someone else the book at that point.
Here's the thing. They, the Turner organization, retained Jim Crockett as an advisor for, I want to say, like a year and a half after they purchased the company. And Jim Crockett, from what I understand, just never got fed up with writing to Turner or writing to Hurd or whoever saying, "You guys need to bring Dusty back." And I mean, I think he would have stayed with Dusty. I mean, he did stay with Dusty until he literally went out of business. So let's say Crockett finds $1 million underneath his sofa cushions and, "Hey, I can stay in business a little while longer." I think we would have just had another 1988 on our hands where the business slowly bleeds to death. And it is true that business picked up a little bit. Actually, it picked up a lot in the summer of 1988, but I don't think that was going to last. You've only got one Ric Flair versus Lex Luger feud. You've only got one Midnight Express versus Tully and Arn feud. Maybe Tully and Arn wouldn't have left if Crockett somehow, you know, if the ship wasn't sinking. But at the same time, you know, I think they just got lucky with those two things. And, you know, things looked up in the beginning of 1988 when they had that really good clash of champions, which at the time, Flair and Sting became the most watched wrestling match in history. But, you know, things got sour again. I think that would have happened again anyway.
It was like when Tito Francona at the end, when he was manager of the Red Sox. I love Tito Francona. I'd love to have him back. At that moment, he had to go. Sometimes you're there too long, and it just people start tuning you out, and you run out of ideas. And Dusty need to get it away. I'm not even getting on him. 4 years is a long time to be running a promotion that size.
It is, and you're absolutely right when you say that. Yeah, after a while, I mean, every booker has his shelf life. Every single one. And I think you're right that, you know, Dusty was great in 85. He was great in 86. He started to really run out of ideas in 1987. And in 88, I mean, he was just, you know, he was finished. That was all there was to it. And I, by the way, I agree with you that they absolutely could have used him as a performer. The problem is, it is a very difficult transition going from being the booker to going back to being one of the boys. And Dusty hadn't been just one of the boys, not just in Crockett. I mean, for a long time,
he was back to Florida in the early 80s. Yeah.
Uh-huh. The 70s. I think he got the book, or at least had a say in the book in the late 70s, mid 70s even. So I think that would have been a really tough transition for him. Yeah, Ole did it, and I think he's the exception rather than the rule.
And this is one of the genius things that Memphis did, because the way they did their booking, they would have Jerry or Dundee do 6 months, Lawler and Dundee do 6 months, and then have Jarrett do 6 months. So
and
you never
no
burned
exception.
Out.
No,
you never burned out.
Territory was on fire. That's how they did it. Because, oh, we're doing well. Well, then when it's time to change bookers, it's a demotion. The way they did it, it was not a demotion. It was just a power share thing, and it worked.
Yep, it worked. The ideas kept fresh. And if you ask, that was the exact purpose. If you ask them, if you ask any one of them, they'll say, yeah, it was great. You get to recharge your batteries, watch what they're doing, get some ideas. And that's, you know, another one of the reasons why they lasted so long.
Mm-hmm. So whose turn is it?
Okay, it is me. I'm looking for it. I know there's a question about ECW that was all over on this. And
you see, that's the thing. We got so many good questions.
I know.
Like, even I'm losing track of them. Like, where's that thing I wanted to answer?
Jesus Rodriguez. I'm hoping I'm pronouncing that right. Let's see. He asked, if you are in charge of ECW, what changes do you make to the product to be attractive nationwide?
I'm glad that question got asked. That was one of the ones I was going to go for.
I don't.
What? Okay, go ahead.
I don't make the move. I don't make the move. They were a good region. That's what they should have stayed with where they were there. Once they every time they tried to expand, it got a little bit worse.
I don't know. I think there's by the time the mid 90s came around, you know, I mean, we've talked about this on the show before. I mean, the days of the territory are over. There's a reason why Home Depot ran Richie Cunningham's dad's hardware store out of business. Okay. It's just not the way I just don't think you can run a territory, or you could run a territory in the 90s, in the early 2000s anymore. It was all about pay-per-view. It was all about video games, etc. I don't think they could have just stuck around the Philadelphia metro area and done well. But the question
the
was,
Northeast.
What's that?
Northeast, like where they were, that kind of Boston, Philly, New York circuit right there.
I think, here's the thing, and we're getting deeper than the question here. I think you had to go national, but at the same time, going national doesn't mean you have to be a national touring company. So, I mean, maybe you're right. What they could have done was just filmed in Queens, filmed in Philadelphia, wherever else where the costs aren't going to break them, as opposed to filming in Los Angeles, Tampa, et cetera. But, you know, so, yeah, you could have done it that way. Here's the thing that I to this day, I mean, I get it, but I don't. Pro wrestling was on fire in the late 90s. It was insane. I mean, you go to the mall, you lose count of kids wearing wrestling shirts, you know, Austin, NWO, whatever. And I just, ECW was already around. It already had an audience. And with wrestling being as hot as it was, I'm really surprised that Heyman was never able to find a suitable network that was willing to partner up with him and, you know, keep ECW around.
And now you run into the problem. The ECW, the early ECW succeeded because it tapped into the anger of a certain fan base. Do you remember what those old WCW shows were like in Philadelphia at the end?
I do.
Yeah.
Oh, it was ECW fans.
They were, even before then, they were booing all the baby faces out of the building. I mean, you remember what they did to, we've talked about this before, what they did to the dudes.
Oh, yeah, the dudes and Tommy Rich at that the Halloween show in Philadelphia. I was there, and it was way worse live than it was on TV. TV did not do it justice.
Paul saw all this, and he tapped into that anger.
Mm-hmm.
That's why the show worked. Once you start to go national, you start to have to water it down a little bit. And that's why Paul had that reputation. He couldn't get on pay-per-view forever for this because he portrayed himself as such a crazy maverick. He had the same problem with the TV stations. They're all afraid of him.
Another issue, too, which would have made it hard for ECW, well, two things. Number one, we already saw that Meltzer was saying the whole time there's not going to be two national promotions forever, let alone three. And he was right. There's a reason why there's only one NFL. There's only one Major League Baseball, one Major League Basketball League. It's just that's the way it always goes. Number two, and Bischoff says he didn't do it. Bischoff says he never saw ECW, so how could he possibly steal ECW's ideas? I'm not someone who dislikes Eric Bischoff, but I don't believe that. It's just too large a coincidence that all of the things that a lot of the concepts that ECW was using, he suddenly started to use. And then the WWF upped the ante even more. So why are you watching ECW in 1999 when the WWF is doing a major league version of ECW?
He'll give credit to Choshu, but he won't give credit to Heyman. The gift to ECW, as much as it's kind of gone, like ECW in the early days was overrated for their influence. Okay, they're like, this is the third big of the big three. No, it's not. Settle down. Okay, it's not even close. Okay, and then it went to, yeah, but look what the type of wrestling was, you know, remembering it at the end, not remembering at the beginning, where they were using a big variety of talent. So actually, they did two things. One is they made the other businesses rethink their model. Even if they didn't go completely with them, they made them kind of break out of the rut they were in and force them to look at it differently.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what led to, it wasn't necessarily them taking their ideas, but it was them adapting to kind of them showing it's a new world now. Okay, that was one. Two was, look at the talent that came out of there, just as a development, just as an opportunity to get on stage the first time. This is what you're missing today. I mean, that was perfect for a lot of those guys who would not have gotten a job otherwise, or at least a job on that scale.
It was like Heyman could figure out, like, okay, Sabu is a hidden talent, or he came up with the gimmick for Sandman, came up with the gimmick for Public Enemy, saw something in Tommy Dreamer. And then when those guys, a lot of them left and it was time to come up with the new guy, he didn't have like the talent. He wasn't able to identify the second wave. Okay, who's the new guy I need to get over? Where's my gimmick for this guy? It's just, it wasn't there. And another issue, actually more to directly speak to what Jesus was asking us, you know, what could they have done? Well, one thing Heyman could have done is recognize that Tommy Dreamer was not a good booker and just say, you know, get rid of him and get somebody else. I mean, he was pretty terrible.
Why do you take Tommy Dreamer as a booker there?
Why would I make him the booker?
Why would he, if you're Paul Heyman?
I'm guessing Heyman made him the booker because Tommy was invested in ECW. He was, you know, one of the guys who answered the phone when, you know, someone called up asking for merch. So it was probably more of a loyalty thing. And yeah, I mean, I could see giving him a chance out of loyalty, but when you see his actual product, you know, at some point you gotta like be like, man, Tommy, you know, you need help with this.
You remember how Paul got his job at ECW?
It depends on which version you're
Yeah. Well, I'm talking about the version where he kind of, you know, kind of pushed out. Pushed out Eddie Gilbert.
What I understand, he got in Todd Gordon's ear about, you know, Eddie Gilbert, who was Paul's like best friend at the time, just wasn't the right guy for the book. And
so if you did that to somebody else, wouldn't you have it in the back of your head that it could be done to you?
Sure.
So of course you're going to take Tommy Dreamer. He's not a threat.
Yeah, but now it's Heyman's company. And he can do what he wants.
It doesn't matter. Paul's Paul. I mean, because he had the company, it doesn't matter. You still have those same neuroses, which partly made him great, but also was probably his demise. He had no assistance in developing talent and doing anything. Pretty much. He never gave up too much of the company. He was always in total control, and he was starting to burn out. Well, he was more than starting to burn out. He was starting to burn out at the end of 96.
Yeah. I mean, there's stories in 2002 where he's trying to tell Stephanie McMahon what to do.
And because he did not have that second layer, and he can't be everywhere, you start having incidents like you had in Wonderland, you know, at the end of 96 with Mass Transit, which kept him off pay-per-view for months. And that was just because he could not delegate down.
You know what? You're making an excellent case here.
It's actually a very similar situation to happen to Crockett.
If you think about it, that's true.
Yeah.
I mean, Dusty was Crockett's guy, and, you know, despite the fact that the company had been rotting for a year and a half, 2 years, he not only did he never make a move on Dusty, but long after Dusty was gone, Crockett was saying, hey, Dusty's the guy you need to bring in, which is just crazy.
The worst thing that ever happened to ECW is Paul buying it.
Maybe. I mean, there's the story that he forced out Todd Gordon.
Well, I didn't necessarily have to be Todd, but it was basically whether Todd was the mole. And they actually used the whole story in the storyline, which is funny.
Yeah.
But whether he was the guy kind of helping to facilitate talent at WCW. I just mean, it didn't have to be him, but you had to have a checks and balances with Paul.
Yeah.
And for the love of God, he needed an accountant.
if you believe, I mean, well, that's the story in wrestling. It's always the accountant's fault. Like, that's what Crockett and Dusty tried to foist on everybody.
Oh no, I'm saying he didn't have one.
Get out of here.
I'm saying he didn't have one. I'm thinking that whole finance were done on like little napkins someplace.
Okay,
you know,
isn't it?
Yeah, from the way they all talk about it, this wasn't the tightest ship ever run.
No, and you're right. That's where he needs outside consulting help for the business end, which he probably just didn't have the money for. But one thing, too, I just want to throw this out there really quickly. Todd Gordon says that it was all his decision. He decided to go with Paul instead of Eddie, and that, you know, this was basically all a false accusation made by Eddie Gilbert. And, you know, I don't want to say I knew Eddie Gilbert, but I've been around him a few times. Eddie was a really good guy. But if you watch Eddie Gilbert's 1993 ECW, I thought the booking was not that good. I'm sorry. I mean, Eddie and the whole King of Philadelphia thing that he was doing with himself, I mean, that was I mean, who could possibly think that was good for business and not just good for Eddie's ego?
Well, he obviously did the King of Philadelphia. He was trying to impersonate Lawler. But you have to push him. Who else did they have back then?
It doesn't even matter. Eddie had turned the show.
Tony Cairo.
Eddie Gilbert Hour. Well,
Tony Cairo.
That was part of the problem. That's Tommy Cairo, I know.
You had Sandman. Okay, you had Sandman as an actual surfer.
Yes.
Surfing Sandman.
Yeah, I remember that.
Yes, which is, you know, he would come to the ring with Big Shot by Billy Joel.
But that was part of the problem. Eddie wasn't looking at fresh talent. He was just like, okay, well, here are the guys who live near here and are available. And he didn't, you know, try to bring in a Sabu. He didn't create a crazy gimmick like Public Enemy.
Well, I mean, the beauty is, the reason they came up with the crazy gimmick, and this shows you the difference between the two. The reason they came up with the crazy gimmick for Public Enemy was because, what else are you going to do with them?
I mean, nothing. You could just go with someone else.
But, I mean, that's what Paul did. Paul would take guys of limited talent and plug them into the perfect hole and somehow make it work. And as he always liked to say, you emphasize the positive, you hide the negative. And that's in the early, year and a half, 2 years, he was a genius at it. I mean, he, talk about taking, you know, shining up some shinola. That's what he was doing. I mean, he really was a miracle worker there for a couple of years, but there's only, he needed to start developing people under him. That was the problem. So again, they were going to collapse no matter what for different reasons. I still don't think the whole beauty of the product was it appealed to a localized audience. And just like the old territories used to, if a territory was going to survive, it would have been that. Maybe you're right. We've had this argument before. I think it could.
Well, we'll never know. I don't think it
right.
could have. But what, again, to emphasize, you had to go nationally as far as, you know, being on television, merchandise, et cetera. That doesn't mean you have to be a national or international touring company. But I'll tell you what, the shows from Japan look really good on TV.
Yeah.
Anyway, Steve Generali asks, what if Vince didn't bring in George Scott to be Booker pre-WrestleMania 1? Who would his Booker have been, and would Piper, Valentine, and Steamboat all come in, or would the new Booker be brought in and other workers, and who would they be?
Oh, I don't. How much do you think George Scott had to do with bringing those guys in?
Probably a little with Piper, but that's about it. I have this weird theory that even before Hogan signed on in Thanksgiving, or right around Thanksgiving of 1983, before Vince, ran in St. Louis and kind of declared war on the rest of the wrestling industry, I think Valentine was coming back. It felt like, I think he came back like February or March of 1984, and felt like it was time for him to come back because he was gone, or he had been gone for 2 years. Like, I have the feeling, and this is just a theory of mine, that Valentine thought he was going to come in and do a three-match series with Backlund in Madison Square Garden again, and the world changed, but Valentine's plans didn't.
He would have been, too bad, he would have been a nifty member of the Four Horsemen originally.
Originally, yeah.
Yeah, have him in, and it would have made sense, too. Have him and Flair and the Andersons.
It would have made total sense, especially in the beginning. I don't know if I hate to get a little bit off the subject here. In 1987, Valentine's contract was expiring with the WWF, and Flair wanted to bring him in as a member of the Four Horsemen, and Dusty was okay with it, and they were negotiating with Crockett, Valentine was negotiating with Crockett. And I'm just like, you know, I mean, this is like late 1987, and Valentine is a shell of what he used to be. And it just goes to show that when Flair and Dusty say, oh, no, we never watched WWF TV, they weren't lying. Because you could tell Greg Valentine at that point was just not Horseman material. 1983 was over. And, you know, luckily for all of us, Valentine got a promise from Vince that he would get a renewed push as a single. He got Jimmy Hart as a manager. He got that shin guard thing for the figure four. And well, that's what happened.
True. But those are actually, those are because by 85, Greg was still pretty good.
Yeah, he kind of went into a steep decline, I want to say, in 85. And then 86, man, he just completely slowed down. And I thought, you know, I thought the, like, 1988, 1989 version of Greg Valentine, maybe even into 1990, I thought he was one of the worst workers out there. And I'm talking, like, bottom 20 of the major promotions, and maybe even bottom 10. But he never got bagged on the way Ultimate Warrior did, because he had that reputation from the 80s. But if you had saw him for the first time, like 1990, you'd be like, what is he doing out here?
No, exactly. Do we have time for another question?
We do. We actually have about 15 more minutes.
Okay, perfect. If Bruno had decided not to take the title back in 1973, who would Vince have used to replace him? What other babyface at that time could have filled that role and kept the WWF rolling?
Okay, I think what they would have done is they would have stuck with Pedro Morales. Morales, there were places he drew well and places he didn't draw well. And I think Vince Sr. gave Bruno a record contract to return to the WWF. The story I had always heard is Sam Muchnick called Vince Sr. and yelled at him because he gave Bruno so much money. I mean, Bruno was making more than the NWA champion. So because of that, people think that Pedro was a colossal failure as WWF champion. He really wasn't, but he wasn't what Bruno was, and that's what they wanted. So I think they would have continued going with Pedro. Jack Briscoe would have been the heavy favorite, and maybe they could have talked him away from the NWA championship, but I don't think they would have, out of loyalty to the NWA. So frankly, I don't know who the heck they would have gone after. My only answer is Pedro.
Okay, a couple of things. One, about your Briscoe comment. Wasn't 1973 right around the time they started messing around with the Dory and the car accident?
That's exactly when it was.
So that may be, he may be receptive at that
true
point.
I just think that it would have been a political thing that they would not have wanted to use. I mean, the NWA would have used the word steal Jack Briscoe from the NWA. I think that's something that, especially in the early 70s, Vince Sr. would have wanted to avoid.
Maybe. But he may have had a receptive ear with, because him and Eddie were friends for a long time.
That probably had a lot to do with it, too. Who was in Florida that might have been like a good pick for WWF champion?
At that time, trying to think who the babyfaces were, Dusty was still a heel.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to think. Paul Jones wasn't tall enough.
That would have been an issue.
Yeah. So I'm not sure. I would have kept it. I think it's an absolute myth that Pedro didn't draw well. Pedro and MSG drew better in the early 70s than Bruno did in the 60s.
No, Pedro drew well in New York. He drew exceptionally well in New York. He drew well in Philadelphia, but he drew well in Boston. What's that?
He drew well here in Boston.
That's not what I've heard.
I always thought he drew well here.
Boston, Pittsburgh, Baltimore, etc. didn't draw particularly well if Pedro was champion. And, you know, I'm someone who always says I think the champion gets too much credit and too much blame. I know when I was growing up and my friends went to go see WWF wrestling, we weren't going to see Bob Backlund or Magnificent Morocco or Ivan Putski. We were going to see wrestling. We were going to see all of it.
Yeah. Who were the tag team champions in 1973? Who was it, Dean Ho and Tony Garea?
Oh, your favorite.
Yeah, I mean, come on. Look what he's working with here. I think that's a myth that Pedro didn't draw well. I think, yeah, okay, maybe he, of course he did draw well in Pittsburgh. I wonder why. You know, I mean, you know, and Baltimore, okay, whatever. But I mean, I always thought Boston, I heard it was okay. I mean, you know, maybe I'm hearing it differently, but I always heard Boston was okay. He drew, I know for a fact, he drew very well in Madison Square Garden.
No, he did. Here's the thing, and I think we just hit the nail on the head. He drew okay, but they wanted better than okay. They wanted what they had when they had Bruno.
Well, I think when Bruno, the opportunity to get Bruno back, all of a sudden it's like, okay, let's bring Bruno back. I'm with you. I don't think if Bruno's not there, they just let Pedro, you know, stay with the championship.
Yeah. Well, here's the thing, and I already said this. They didn't just bring Bruno back. I mean, Vince gave Bruno an offer that Bruno couldn't refuse. I mean, I think he was getting like 10.5% of the gross. And that's like, you know, $6,000-$7,000 of 1973 money for one match at Madison Square Garden.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't like Bruno retired after. He just basically went to Detroit, right?
He went all over the place. He went to Indianapolis, Detroit, Toronto. He went to Japan, but he had a much lighter schedule during that 3-year period.
And he didn't exactly have a killer schedule in WWF, yeah, I say that 10 times. WWF, that schedule supposedly, you know, wasn't brutal either back then.
To Bruno, it was. Bruno said he rarely got to stay home, and that was another condition of his coming out of retirement or coming out of semi-retirement in 74, is that he, or 73, whenever it was, is that, you know, he was going to work for the most part Saturday, Sunday, Monday, and that was it. And, you know, he got to go be home in the middle of the week for the most part.
Because that was always his excuse for not wanting to do the NWA championship.
Well, yeah, I mean, the NWA title champion schedule is absolutely brutal. I mean, Briscoe told the NWA, I don't want to do this anymore. Terry Funk did the same thing.
True. So, I would have just kept it on Pedro. I thought he was doing fine.
Yeah, that's my ultimate answer as well, is that, you know, they would have just stuck with Pedro.
So, all right, you're up. What question do we have?
Okay, what if Bischoff won the war? Would we have a WCW network today or something like that? That's from Chris Zofka.
Yes, you would. You'd have everything you have with WWF now, and it would never happen. This is why. The reason the Choshu bit, you know, with the whole, you know, the invasion angle worked for them is because it was a team effort. So they were able to extend it. You had too many egos trying to fit into that system the way Bischoff was doing it.
Yeah.
And eventually it was going to – you even saw it like midway through. You saw little chinks in the armor. Like the one I always bring up is the War Games match when Henning smashes the door on Flair. That is absolutely the wrong thing to do there. Anyone booking in their right mind knows that's the wrong thing to do there.
But wait a minute.
But the ego's got in the way.
I was going to say, but if you don't do that, you're giving up an opportunity to bury Ric Flair again.
I know. And then, you know, God forbid the NWO needed somebody else because they only had half the roster.
Yeah.
Yeah. That is clearly an ego thing. So you're already seeing the egos. Even at that point, you're seeing egos get into the whole mix. It was going to self-destruct at some point. But, okay, I'll play along. Say he wins. You know, that's the difference with WWF is that you will never let that problem get out of control because Vince will drop the hammer eventually.
Mm-hmm.
And Bischoff wasn't able to do that, especially not with all those favored nation contracts.
Worst thing they ever did. My answer to the question is that no, there would not be a WWF network or a WCW network. I think pro wrestling would be what it is now, except without WWF and WCW. It would be, you know, promotions like Defy and guys like that, and that would be it. I really believe that no matter what, WCW was doomed because they hired Jamie Kellner to run the Turner networks, and Kellner just did not want wrestling, period. That was the end, and he would have, I believe, even if the programs, and they weren't going to be doing like fives and sixes forever like they were, even if the programs were doing, they would have had to be doing incredible for him not to have canceled them. He might have canceled them anyway, but I think it was just, you know, that was it. Kellner did not want wrestling on that network. And if you look at it now, imagine having a pro wrestling show on TNT like they used to have. It just would not fit.
Well, the other problem is that with the salaries they were paying, you had to be getting those ratings.
Yes.
To justify it. And that was not sustainable.
No, it wasn't. You're correct.
That, I hate to go back to Dusty again, but again, this is exactly what happened with them, is that they were paid, when they were drawing like an 85 and 86, sure you could pay those salaries. But even if you start drawing just regular, never mind great, just okay, that's still not going to do it for the salaries they were paying.
No, I agree. And that's the whole thing. You need to have the attendance. You need to have, you know, that revenue from pay-per-view, et cetera, and it just wasn't happening. I'll tell you what, we got like 5 minutes left. Each of us get one more question. Shoot.
Okay. Oh, here's one. Have you ever seen any old British World of Sport matches? Now, just a quick precursor on this. World of Sport is a show. It's not on the BBC. It's on one of the other networks. I can't remember which one. I think it was like Channel 4. But nonetheless, it was on one of the other networks. And it was kind of like a Wild World of Sports for there. And one of the parts they always did was a wrestling segment. And yes, I have seen them. My favorite guy from that time would be Mick McManus, who is a classic, just a classic, annoying, you know, pitcher Tully Blanchard with a bald spot.
I have seen it, but I have not seen it since, I want to say, the early 90s. I had a tape of a bunch of matches from World of Sport, and it was different. It was good, but, you know, I just have so much wrestling stuff that I never had time to watch it again. All right, our final question this week is from Glenn Dubin. How did the WWF succeed with the horrible card they ran at WrestleMania 1? There were three squash matches, Tito, Bundy, Steamboat, Beefcake versus Sammartino, and in parentheses, vomit in my mouth, Andre versus Stud for the 500th time, a women's title bout, two lame title matches, and the main event, which I loved, but not enough. This was like a glorified house show, and it certainly didn't measure up to the lineups at Super Clash, Starcade, or even some Mid-South shows in Houston or the Superdome. What's your opinion on this, Sean?
You are absolutely correct, and it's entirely irrelevant. This was the genius of what McMahon did. The card didn't matter. It was an event.
Yep, that
he
is
made
true.
It look like... I made a note here that it was like the time when Mike Todd, who was a producer, an old Hollywood producer, was making Around the World in 80 Days. And he came up with this stunt where he would have all these celebrities, or have a couple of celebrities do little bit roles. And it became a thing that, you know, if you were any kind of celebrity in Hollywood, you would have a bit role in Around the World in 80 Days. So there was a million of these guys in it now. Vince made it a big deal. He made it important. These guys were everywhere leading up to this event. They were on Saturday Night Live. They were on The Tonight Show. It took away that stigma they used to have about going to wrestling events. He made it mainstream.
That is true. And you know what? That's funny, because that's an excellent point. It's completely different from my point, even though your point is totally valid. How did it succeed? I mean, as far as it being a horrible card, I went to the New Jersey Meadowlands in 1984 for the first NWA show they had up there with Flair, Steamboat in the main event. And imagine my shock when the opening match is Ronnie Garvin against Jake the Snake Roberts. My friends and I couldn't believe it. Why? Because every other show we had ever been to, usually it opened up with two guys who never won on TV wrestling against one another. If you were lucky, you might get like Johnny Rods or Esty Jones against Frank Williams instead of Steve King against Frank Williams. That's just what we were used to. And as far as, you know, WrestleMania being different than any other spectacular show, I mean, if you look at the other, like, stadium shows, especially the WWF ones, I mean, they had squash matches in the opener. If you looked at Starrcade, I mean, they still had Brian Adidas against Masato Ito, I think was the opener on that one. The Texas Stadium shows, same thing. They had prelim matches on those shows. And all of those shows had one thing in common, that it had a main event that was bigger than what you were used to seeing. This wasn't just another Backlund Bruno title defense. You know, the Shea Stadium match had Bruno and Zbyszko in the cage. Starrcade had, you know, Flair regaining the title, and then Flair versus Dusty Rhodes with Joe Frazier as the referee, etc. So basically, that was the supercard that we were all used to on March 31st, 1985.
I mean, you can even go back to 76 when you had Bruno coming back in the first the second Chase Stadium card. Bruno coming back against Stan Hansen.
Mm-hmm. And the opener for that was two guys who rarely went on TV, Kevin Sullivan and Jose Gonzalez, going to a 20-minute draw.
They made it an event. Even you can even see, actually, Vincent J would do this. Because you'd see, I love watching those old garden shows in the 70s for that reason. Is that it always felt like a big deal.
Yeah. So anyway, if anyone out there asked a question and it didn't get answered, it's not because, you know, we don't like you or we didn't like the question. It's, man, we've only got an hour. And to wrap up, I want to invite everyone to check out the Stick to Wrestling Facebook page. It's real easy to find. And this has been a production of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week. Go Vols, beat Florida.